Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 31st, 2014. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
I thought about opening the show with like a little Johann Sebastian Bach toccata and fugue in D minor. You know, the people call it the Vincent Price song. Because it's Halloween today.
It is Halloween.
And I was wondering, who are you going as? I know you get dressed up every year, so what are you
I'm going as a campaign poll phone call maker.
Oh, so you're going to have a lot of doors basically slammed in your face.
Exactly. It's going to be a quick Halloween for me. No, seriously, I got back with this cruise, right? And I'm still one of the 12 people under the age of 75 in this country that has a landline.
Uh-huh.
And you actually might be one too, right?
Yes, I am actually.
So I went to check the voicemail. There are 20 messages.
Wow.
And I listened to all of them because you never know. There might be, you know, I might have won the publisher's clearinghouse or somewhere in the middle of that, right?
Yeah.
So, 15 of them campaign phone calls or polls. The other five telemarketers that literally are so stupid that they could not understand that they're talking to a machine. So I had like five more like, hey, Mr. Long, is that you? Are you there? Hello? Mr. Long? So I'm going to be happy here come Tuesday when election day is done and, yeah. And the phone quiz ringing. So, but yeah, I think that would be a good good costume. You know,
it's funny you said that because I have the caller ID on the TV, so I screen the calls, and if it's somebody I don't know, I just click phone on, phone off, and hang up on them. But once it was a local number, so I wasn't sure what it was, so I decided to screen the call and let the answering machine come on. So the answering machine does its thing, and then it's a lady in the background, and she's like, "Uh-huh, yeah, no, 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 you don't do the fried chicken that way,
awesome.
No." And she's talking for like 10 minutes about how to do fried chicken and what's going on with her
I
baby daddy.
That down, man. I like some fried chicken.
But she left out some key ingredients, you know. So I really couldn't benefit from it other than getting a good belly laugh out of it. But I'm just listening to this lady fill up my answer machine, and it was just hilarious. I'm like, you know that she's a slacker at work because she's like, oh, good. Oh, good, I'm connected. I could just sit here now and milk it for the next 10 minutes and not have to do any more calling for the next 10 minutes. And then she's just sitting there talking to her friend. And I'm like, you literally called the phone number, and you're sitting there with the phone up to your ear, or you got the headset on, and you know it's quiet on the other end, and you're just sitting there having a conversation. What do you think is happening on my end, lady? How do you not figure that out?
Oh, man, that's kind of like the gobble, gobble, gobble woman in Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
So I'm going as John Candy then, apparently.
Oh, excellent. Very.
Get
very
it, John
good.
Candy, for Halloween. Thank you very much. So anyway, happy Halloween, everybody. And to you too, Scott. Glad you're home. That was a long cruise, and I'm sure there was some trepidation, too, while you were there. Was there not?
Well, you know, every cruise, as you know, is stressful before you go in because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, all our equipment and all that kind of stuff. And this cruise particularly because we only had, I believe, 6 repeat passengers. Normally we have, you know, a ton of repeat passengers on this cruise, but this is our first time sailing out of Galveston, Texas, so a brand new area for us. So we wasn't expecting a lot of familiar faces and didn't get them. So that meant we had 104 brand new folks to the Ante Up cruise family. And so that's a little – it's exciting. It's also a little scary because, you know, folks don't have a really good – understanding of what they're going to experience. So, you know, if we're not delivering, then it's going to be a long cruise at sea.
Yeah.
Because you can't get away from them, right?
Yeah.
And, or if we do deliver, it's going to be a fantastically fun cruise. And I'm happy to report that it was the latter. Had an absolute phenomenal time on this cruise. This is one of the best ones ever. Everybody was having a great time. You know, we always have that one person that's got some kind of problem, right?
Yeah.
And we really didn't have that this time at all. Everybody has a good time. Everybody's talking about coming on future cruises, which we love to hear. So, you know, we made new friends, and there'll be new repeat passengers in the future. And, you know, all of our equipment got there as easy as possible. I mean, it was there actually before we were there. I've never seen that happen before. So, you know, a lot of the stress that comes with operating these cruises was gone, and we just had an absolute blast on this trip.
Very good.
Someone that made the cruise even more fun for all of our passengers, Brian Devonshire, who I know a lot of our listeners probably know. He finished 12th in the World Series main event a couple years back. He's got a couple circuit rings, $2.5 million in tournament winnings. He called me like last minute and said, "Hey, can you get me on? I'll be happy to teach some classes." So we got him on, and I got to tell you, this dude is hilarious. First, he's got the big old afro, right?
Yeah. So,
and he's got this laid back demeanor, and you know, because we never know about this. I know you're talking about, you and I talk about this all the time. We never know what we're going to get from folks that are pros, right?
Yeah.
There's obviously some really good ones, very nice ones, fun ones to hang out with. There's also quite a few jerks that let fame get to their head and are tough to deal with. He was so laid back and fun to have on board. He played in the poker room every night and just had people in stitches, taught fantastic classes, learned a ton from him. He taught all three classes, so I didn't have to do anything but just sit there and smile.
Nice.
Which is good. He had my wife in stitches the first night because he was going through these series of cow jokes. So I can't do him justice because I'm not Brian Devonshire, but I'm going to try here. What do you call a cow with no legs?
I don't know what.
Ground beef. What do you call a cow with one leg?
I don't know what.
Steak. See? Yeah. Now you can imagine even a funnier guy saying this at the poker table.
Yeah, yeah.
And people just losing it. I mean, these are not like, you know, late night quality jokes. They're just funny kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the atmosphere that Brian brought to the cruise this time. And really, really enjoyed him. And obviously, he was a monster at the tournament table. But one of the funniest things happened. Our second tournament of the cruise was a bounty tournament. And we kind of redid this. Actually, we kind of redid all of our tournaments this time to make them a little bit more fun. This one was a $100 buy-in with a $25 bounty. And, of course, we have these god-awful, ugly, yellow $25 ships that we use, right?
Yeah.
So it was great because you knock somebody out, now you got a yellow bird, we called it, right?
Yeah.
So getting on the final table, and it was great to see the final table because obviously Brian was there. We kind of figured that. But two of our ambassadors were at the final table. Poker Geek MN, John Somsky, was there. He had a phenomenal tournament week. And then our newest ambassador for Louisiana, Danny Wade. And Danny had – he got Debo, as he goes by, on the ropes, crippled him, left him with just a couple chips, right? And that's the worst thing you can do in a bounty tournament, right? Because you don't get the bounty.
Right.
And now somebody else is just going to come by and just get lucky and knock that guy out, get the $25 that you did the hard work for, right?
Yeah.
So that's exactly what happened. John knocked him, knocked Evo out a couple hands later. And as John got his bounty chip, Danny was like, "Man, I'll buy that from you for $26. Let's do it." And John, without missing a beat, said, "I will take that deal." So he gives him $26, right? He gives him the bounty chip. Danny goes on to wins the tournament and comes to cash out, and he gives us all his yellow – he had a ton of bounties, right? He gives us all these yellow chips, and I'm like, "Hey, which one is the Devo bounty chip?" And he's like, "Oh, man. I mixed it in with all the rest of them."
Oh, no.
So we essentially gave John $1 for absolutely nothing.
Oh, man. That's hilarious.
But a lot of fun to see people at the tournament tables having a good time. Again, no shock, Devonshire went on to win our main event, and I was having fun with him because, you know, all these people get Annie up Poker Tour Player of the Year points, right? And we sent all the results to Hendon Mob. So if you're looking for an easy, cheap way to get on Hendon Mob, come on a cruise and win one of our $20 tournaments.
That's right.
But he cashed in like the $20 tournament for like $200 or something like that. I don't know what it was, right? And then when he's cashing out, he's like, "Man, I can't wait to send have that added to your Hendon Mob." He's like, "Yeah, that might round me up to $2.5 million. But funny dude, of course, then, like, so he went on to win our main event, and this is what we really tried, really out of the box thinking and trying to do something different with our main event, and we decided to do it on this cruise because we knew we didn't have a lot of repeat passengers that had an expectation of what we do, so essentially we had 100 Texan guinea pigs right. on this cruise where we could try it, and if it failed, then, you know, no one was too upset that, you know, expected something else from us. And if it went great, then we knew we could roll this out to the rest of our cruises. So so here's kind of the idea. I mean, one of the things that we struggle with on these cruises, as you know, is once the ship leaves the dock, there aren't no other players coming in, right? We don't helicopter players in for the mainland. Right. Whatever group we have, that's the group that's going to be playing with us all week. So it's kind of tough to get a real impressive prize pool for our tournaments when we have 100 to 200 people, whatever it ends up being on these cruise ships, right? And we tried some in the past, some real big buy-in main events like 350. What we realized is, you know, people were already paying to come on the cruise and they're playing poker all week, and then asking them to pay 350 for a tournament the last day is tough, right? Even yeah. satellites. So for the last, couple years now, we've been doing $100 main event. It's been fun, it's friendly, right? But the problem is we don't get a big prize pool, right? So what we came up with is this thing we call the Tidal Wave, which I kind of thought was a cool name. I'm the one who came up with it, right? Mm-hmm. Because the way the structure of the tournament works, it sounds like a tidal wave on a cruise ship. Of course, we get on the cruise ship and everybody's like, why didn't you just call it Ebola, Scott? How about scaring the rest of me out? I'm like, oh, come on! But name aside, people really, really liked it. So I'm interested in what the rest of our listeners say. Because we're making a couple tweaks before we do the next cruise. But here's kind of the format. Instead of a $100 buy-in, it's a $65 buy-in. And you start with a six-handed single table. So we ran these the entire cruise. Like, the first night, the room opened, the first six people sat down, they were in, right? The top two finishers in each of these moved on to what we call the championship day, which is really technically a day two on the last day of the cruise, our normal spot for the main event, right? Uh-huh. They take their stacks with them, and they could play all week, and if they got up to five stacks, they combine that into one stack, kind of borrowing from our good friends at Derby Lane for their Annie Poker Tour accumulator that's coming up, right?
Yep.
And, of course, if you kept playing and you got more stacks, then we'd give you $150 out of the prize pool for all the stacks that you couldn't combine. So the idea was to get people playing often, build that prize pool up, give some people incentive to keep playing after they qualified. And I got to say, people just really, really, really liked it. And, people came in after dinner, hey, when's the next tidal wave getting started? And that's the kind of stuff you like to hear on these cruise ships, that people are excited with the product you're offering them. And it ended up working. We ended up with a prize pool of $63.75. Not bad for having 110 passengers or
right.
70 players on board. I think we had 139 entrants, which is pretty cool. And top price was $22.48. You know, that's not going to turn heads in your local poker room, but on a cruise ship, that's not bad. Particularly if you sneaked in for just a $65 investment, it's not bad. So people really had a lot of fun with it. We got a couple tweaks, and we're asking some folks for some more feedback, and I think we're going to make it better for the next cruise in December. But definitely was fun.
Very cool. You know, we and I never really actually talked about it. I think it was right when I was getting back from Italy or whatever, you kind of announced that or something, and I never really had time to sit down and think about it. So I was real curious to see how it was going to pan out, and it sounds like we're on to something here, so that's really good.
Yeah, it's good to have folks like Poker Geek on board with us, you know, these math guys, because they quickly do the math. Because what we did is we also offered, we didn't want to not offer a direct buy-in on the last day for folks if they wanted to, but we also wanted to make it fairly ridiculous to encourage people to actually play the sit-and-goes instead, because if you had everybody buying in, then it ruins the whole point, right? So I think we made it something like $1,000 or something to get in the last day. And, of course, no one did it. And but Geek was Poker Geek was doing the math all week and telling me, he's like, well, I think the proper amount of buy-ins would be this. And so it's really cool, man. And using kind of that analysis as we go forward, and maybe make some tweaks to both sides of it. But people really enjoyed it. So
good. Very cool.
What people didn't love is Texas and their crazy liquor laws there, man. I went to college just near, not too far from Pennsylvania, and I thought that state was messed up with liquor laws. But down in Texas. So here's the thing. Folks that have been on a cruise before, if you haven't been on a cruise before, when we get on the very first day before dinner, we have an open bar cocktail party. You know, get everybody together. plow them full of drinks and snacks, and I get up there and do a boring spiel. You get up there and do a less boring spiel, and you know, it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the week, right?
Yeah.
So they told us when we booked this cruise, you know, I'm sorry, Texas has some liquor laws. We're not able to do the open bar cocktail party on the first day, but we'll do it the last night for you. I'm like, all right, fine, whatever. I mean, yeah, you can't fight City Hall, right? Or the State House or whatever it is we're fighting in. And so I'm like, well, let's at least do an informational session the first day so we can get everybody the information. So we did that, did the cocktail party on the last night, and really kind of enjoyed it. I asked a bunch of our folks that have been on before what they thought, and we're kind of split down the middle because I didn't think about, but what's kind of cool to see is when you have the open bar cocktail party the last night, everybody's made friends on the cruise ship, right?
Yeah.
It's more of a party because when you go to that first day, it's kind of like the middle school dance, you know, where people are just all kind of separated and not willing to talk to anybody because they're kind of scared, right?
Yeah.
The last day, everybody knows everybody, so everybody's just having a big, huge party, and so that was kind of cool. So, but we kind of went back and forth on which way, because we could do it both ways going forward if we want to. I think that the consensus was to keep it the way we normally do, but it, you know, hey, we made lemon schnapps out of lemons. this thing, and then. You know, again, I forget that this is Texas, right? And they want to build a freaking wall on their border to keep people out, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you and I are, we get off the ship first thing in the morning if we can because we got to get our equipment and all that stuff. And customs is really, I don't want to call it a joke because it's serious stuff, right? But it's, you get off a cruise ship, it's nothing like if you're flying back from some foreign country. You know, you pretty much walk through and they ask you a question or two and move on. Sometimes you get off the port and they don't even ask you anything. They just collect your little customs form and wave you through, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Not in Texas, my friend. So this cruise, we didn't have to get our equipment off, which was beautiful. Our flight wasn't until 3 o'clock, so we were in no hurry to get off the ship. So we got off like at 10 o'clock. Like, I think you had to be off by 10:30. So we got off like at 10. An hour and a half in the customs line.
Huh.
To get through it. And they were, you know, asking questions left and right. It was brutal. I mean, you had all, it was like going to, like, you know, Disney World and getting in the line, right? And then you see the line snaking back and forth, right? And finally get into the room and you're like, hey, I'm on the ride. And you're like, no, I'm sorry. Another series of snakes in this room.
Oh, man.
And you get through that and they're like, all right, I'm on the ride now. Nope. Hey, one more snake in a row. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. It was brutal. It was an hour and a half to get through. Fortunately, our flight was late, later in the day, so. We still had time to do our Waffle House breakfast on the way back and get to the airport. But I had no idea it would be like that. And so, I mean, and we talked to a couple passengers in line, and they're like, oh, yeah, always like this here in Galveston.
Man.
They don't want anybody getting in Texas.
Wow. I mean, that doesn't beat Miami, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, Miami is a whole different animal. That was more our equipment.
Yeah.
Problems there. Yeah. I don't think it was too much problem getting off the ship as it was for passengers.
Yeah, no, it was just customs with our.
This was all passengers going through that.
That's crazy.
And, you know, as I was telling Laura, my wife, you know, had we were trying to get our flight earlier when we realized we didn't have to get our equipment off, and unfortunately the prices went up, so we didn't do it. Had we done that, a good chance we wouldn't have missed the flight because. The way we did here, we knew we kind of built it breakfast into the day, right? So we got off at 10 and still had 5 hours to get to the airport and breakfast and everything. Had we not done that, we wouldn't have built breakfast in. We would just thought we could just get off, hop in a cab, and go to the airport. We would have been in this line for an hour and a half. So,
man.
So pretty crazy, but hey, gotta love Texas, right?
Yeah.
All right, so that's enough talking for me, but folks, if you want to come on our cruises, remember we're still booking guests for our December 15th cruise out of Tampa. We'll have staterooms in our control for our Valentine's cruise, February 9th to the 13th out of Port Canaveral, in our control only through November 24th, and from what I'm understanding, the prevailing rates are very high for that cruise, so if you want to go on that one, you're going to want to book while we still have cabins in our control, so yep. Give us a call by November 24th, and for more details on this, on those two cruises, or any of our cruises next year, or to book, visit antiupcruises.com.
You remember when we were taping the show early? And I was like, Sky, you know something's going to happen while we tape the show early, and we're going to get screwed because we taped the show early, and something always happens when you're gone or whatever. Well, it happened again.
It sure did, didn't it?
Every single time, and, you know, we should have expected this, but, you know, we talked about the Poker Hall of Fame inductees, you know, and who the guys were who were up for it, and then we had a little conversation who we thought was going to get in. Well, of course they announced who's going to be inducted while you're gone. And no surprise really here, Danny Nugrani and Jack McClellan, they're going to be inducted on November 9th at Binion's, which of course is where the World Series actually started.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not surprised by that, right? I mean, we kind of are always surprised by who gets left out, but we're never really surprised by who gets in.
Yeah, I think we talked about it when we went through the 10 nominees that they're all qualified. You know, some we thought were probably a little too early, or some were more qualified than others, but they're all qualified.
Right.
So wouldn't have been shocked of anybody that got in. I think I mentioned before, I really thought Jack McClellan would get in because they seem to have a soft spot for tournament directors that really grew in the game. So that one wasn't a shock to me. I would say it might be a little surprise that Nugrani got in on the first year. He's 40. It's the youngest he can be to get in. So only he and Chip Reese are inducted at age 40. I mean, certainly he's done a ton for the game. You know, whether you like him or not, he's obviously a very skilled player. He's very outspoken. He's got gets credit for improving tournament structures and tournament things like that. And calling out folks that need to be called out for. So he's certainly well qualified. I don't know why I'm an ageist here, but I just kind of feel like you need to be a little older.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. And the thing about it, too, is the word fame right there. I mean, there is nobody on that list more popular than Dan Nugrani.
That's true. Absolutely.
So you add that to it, too, and it's like, yeah, I guess I can understand how he gets it on the first ballot. I mean, of course he deserves it. They all deserve it. It's just a matter of time. But yeah. But congratulations to those two, and looking forward to, who's going to get in next year.
Yeah, next year will be the 49th and 50th.
Yeah.
So somebody will be the 50th inductee to the Hall of Fame. Huh. So you almost want to come in second next year, right? So you can say that.
That's right. All right, we got a lot of...
Go first. I want to be 50th.
Yeah, I'll gladly be 49th. We got a lot of Annie Up updates. So the schedules have been announced for our next three Annie Up Poker Tour events, November 19th to the 23rd at Pensacola Greyhound Track, of course in Florida, November 25th to the 30th at our good friends Thunder Valley Casino Resort in California, and now December 11th to the 14th, Palm Beach Kennel Club in Florida. And don't forget our Annie Up Poker Tour series at Derby Lane starts tomorrow, right, if you're going to listen to this on actual Halloween, November 1st, and it runs through November 16th, and you can expect to see a lot of our people there. So
sure.
Come out and see us to have a good time, and if you want to find out any more about any of these events, you can go to annieatpokertour.com. And Dover Downs, the hotel and casino in Delaware, will feature a cruise package for our April 10th sailing out of Baltimore in a tournament on November 20th. Top half of the players get their buy-in back, and we'll play out in a free roll for the cruise package. Visit AnnieUpCruises.com for more details on that as well.
Yeah, I kind of like this, because the last time I visited up there and did that tournament last month, or actually earlier this month, I guess.
When you were the boss?
Yeah, when I was the boss.
Yeah.
And showed them how I was a boss by, getting felted twice.
That's how you do it.
Yep.
Keep your clientele happy.
But I was talking to Pete, the manager up there, about the new double bubble thing that PokerStars is doing at the PCA, and he loved the concept. So this is kind of his twist on the double bubble, that everybody's going to play to half half, get their money back, and then it becomes a free roll. I think it's kind of a cool way of doing it.
Yeah.
So, and he says if it takes off, then he's going to be doing these, I believe, twice a month for the next couple months. So if you want to go on an Antioch cruise out of Baltimore, and this is a good way of doing it for. I forget how much it is. It's very nominal.
But, very affordable.
Go down to Dover Downs and try it out.
Each week we spotlight a listener who calls our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emails us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something cool. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the app today by visiting the iTunes store. It comes from Justin Lee. And he says, I know some tournaments have a rule that says no chopping or deals at the final table. Is this rule truly enforceable? And if so, what's the penalty? My question specifically involves this rule at our home game, which was a 10-man winner-take-all $60 satellite to play in a World Series of Poker circuit, $365 event with lodging and travel. We all agreed on no deals before the satellite started. Our satellite gets down to heads up, and the two players left start discussing a deal. Because one of them says, hey, I'm not able to play in the circuit event now. So the other player offers him cash in exchange for the seat. The two remaining players say that it is fair and doesn't affect anyone else because it's heads up now, without any regard to our agreed upon no chopping rule. Do the knocked out players have any recourse or standing to enforce the rule? How can you make the two remaining players play it out if they are insistent on a deal? Is it fair or honest for them to make a deal at the end, which is against the original rule?
This is an interesting scenario, I think, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of wrote back to him kind of from my casino environment response, right? And not so much the home game thing. And he wrote back some interesting stuff, so I think we'll have a good chat here about it. But for the casino environment, what I tell him is obviously casinos can dictate whatever they want, right? They're the ones paying out the money, and that's a lot of casinos, that's what I'm like. You know, when people start talking a chop, then Florida gets in there and say, hey, you guys, we're paying out based on how the prize pool is. You guys can figure that out. If you guys want to go in the parking lot and make out some kind of deal afterwards, that's between you guys. But in this casino, I'm paying out like this. So in that sense, it is technically enforceable within the casino, but we live in a free country, free world, right? So if you go out in the parking lot and you want to make a deal there, there's absolutely nothing in my mind that can stop you from doing that, right?
Yeah.
So I would say, so then to take it to the home game thing here, I think it's the same thing. Your group here has made an agreement that there will be no chopping, but there's absolutely nothing to stop these two guys from not having this discussion there or having it telepathically or whatever, right? Hey, let's take a break, and they both go to the bathroom together and have people rumor about them. And talk, hey, let's chop this up when we get home. I just don't see how you could enforce that. So I get back to his first question. I don't think stuff that happens outside of these events, whether it's a home game or a casino, can be enforceable. How would you enforce it?
Yeah. No, I agree. You can't enforce it outside. You can't. I mean, it's a free country here, at least. And, I mean, I just the thing that gets me about it is, well, one, what's this guy doing playing in? If he knows he can't play in the circuit event, that's one. But that's not this part of this discussion, really. The other thing is, like, all right, how do you enforce a home game? You know, you're going to piss off two of your best friends to make sure that they, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, so let's say the guy who can't go wins. Then he turns to the other guy and says, hey, I can't go. You want to buy the seat from me? Okay. Well, you can't stop that from happening, so what's the big deal when it gets heads up? I mean, it's not like there was collusion here where those two guys said, hey, I can't go, so if I get heads up with you, I'll sell you my seat, so let's keep raising together so we get the third guy out. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff didn't happen. So,
well,
I mean,
interesting,
right?
Interestingly enough, you bring that up because that was so far away from my mind, I didn't think about it. So when I was emailing back with Justin, I kind of asked him, you know, politely, I'm like, what's the big deal? I mean, if it gets down to the final two and these two people want to make a deal, everybody else is out of the tournament. It's not like they started a chop discussion with four other people in the tournament, right? Which would have been a bigger deal. And that's exactly what he said, is one of the reasons that they had this rule is that they didn't want to encourage collusion between two players working together, knowing that they could be able to chop it up.
Hmm.
Man. Which I guess I could say is, if you're really worried about collusion in your home game, I think maybe you need to get a different home game.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, if
you're kind of worried about that in a casino, and you can't really do too much about it other than get up and leave, right? But in a home game, you can pick and choose who you play with.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. There's, if you're playing with the type of people that would cheat you or angle shoot you or whatever, then get out of that home game or throw them out of it, and then, you know, deal with this one time pulling off of the Band-Aid type thing and then move on. But I mean, I if there's collusion in our home game and I find out about it, someone's going home with a limp. I gotta tell you, and then they're not coming back either. So
what if I'm already limping?
Well, then you're going home with two limps. You're going home in a wheelchair. Something's happening to you that is not going to be pleasing. Let's just say that. But really, yeah. I mean, if there's really talk of collusion in your home game, then you got bigger problems than worrying if they're going to chop it when they get heads up.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's the case, because I can really see that as the only reason you don't have a. Either you don't have a chop deal like this, or you make a big deal about the fact that the final two decide to chop it at the end. You know, I guess in a practical sense, I mean, dealing with it going forward, you know, I don't know how well you like these two people, but, I mean, that would be the practical solution to say, hey, we all agreed on this. You guys reneged on it. I don't care whether the rest of us weren't in the tournament. See ya. You're not going to come back anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a tough thing to do if you know, if you like these guys other way than that. Other than that, the other thing I kind of told him too is, you know, I mean, I didn't get the whole collusion thing right away. I had Justin explain it to me, right? So maybe these two players didn't understand it either. So it's also an opportunity to have a conversation. Hey, here's why the rest of us didn't want to do it. And the fact that you're chopping now, I mean, not that we're suspecting you of collusion, but you know, you're opening up the possibility, and we don't want to have the possibility open it up in this game. And those two players might be, oh my gosh, hey, I'm just like Scott Long. I didn't know. And I'm sorry. And next time we play, we won't chop. You never know until you have that conversation.
Yeah, this is a really bizarre situation. And the other thing, too, the word enforce. It's like it's a home game. It's like, what are you going to do? You're going to ban them from your home game. Okay, well, that's the best you can probably do because you're not going to call the cops on your... You know what I mean?
It's like, that'd be great. Hey, it's like, hey, someone stole my pot.
Exactly right. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Good luck, Justin. Hope that works out for you. All right, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com and we'll have Golden Nugget Las Vegas poker director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This comes from Kava Saidi. He says, I was in a 3-6 limit game. After the river fell, small blind threw queen 5 over the betting line and on top of the muck face up for a pair of queens. I interpreted this as a muck, so I bet out. The button folded, and I immediately asked if the small blind mucked. The dealer told me that his cards were live and not mucked. The small blind, realizing that perhaps he had the winner, called. I asked for the floor. The dealer told me that the floor was just going to make the same decision and told me to turn him over my hand. I insisted on calling the floor. The dealer then explained his decision again, and I just repeated, call the floor. The floor came and quickly ruled the hand stood as played. I'm fine with the ruling, but I didn't like that I had to argue with the dealer to get that ruling.
No doubt. All right. Well, Sam says, this is what makes my job very tough at times. I apologize for you having to deal with a dealer who refused to call the floor. You have every right to ask for a floor decision, and it should have been done on the first request. I hope this doesn't discourage you from playing elsewhere in the future.
I would say that if this happened in Sam's room, Sam would be in the break room waiting for the dealer.
Yeah,
to say to him,
actually,
hey,
not even waiting in the break room.
Yeah, you might pull him out right there. But
little UFC tap out.
But that is just unacceptable. I mean, I can see like sometimes where a dealer, if somebody doesn't call the floor, dealer might interpret a rule on his own, and you know, because he's seen it a million times, and he's going to get a, you know, they're going to understand it, and whatever. But as soon as he says, I got to have a floor tell me that, you don't say, no, the floor's going to tell you what I told you. Keep playing. No way.
And you know what gives me the red ass about this? And we have this conversation often with the folks in our cruise dealers and stuff, because a lot of them are floors in their real life. They come on the ship for fun and deal, right?
Right.
And, you know, what they say all the time is, I just don't understand why dealers refuse to call the floor. I mean, why, as a dealer, why would you not want to call the floor? When you call the floor becomes the bad guy or bad girl, depending on who it is,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
It totally absolves you of anything unless you obviously did something to screw up the hand, right?
Yeah.
But even then the floor can explain why, even though you screwed up the hand, this is how it's going to be. I mean, that's what they're there for. I mean, that's what the floor is. That's why not a lot of people like to be a floor, because you have to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
The dealer is just dealing cards at that point. So if someone wants a floor, if I'm dealing... Floor!
Yeah, absolutely.
Table 6, pronto, get over here, because I want them to hate you, not me.
Now, I will go on record as saying that there are institutions that actually keep track of how many times a floor needs to be called to your situation.
True, that is true.
And there's not explained in detail why the floor was called, so all you see is Joe Dealer got called to floor 5 times today, even though 4 of them were player error.
Yeah.
And had nothing to do with him or whatever. So I think that a lot of them may have that where they're scared because they don't want to lose their job in such a horrible economy, blah, 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 blah. So that could be it. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, essentially, if you don't have a place like that where they understand that you're just doing what's best for the player and best for the institution, then calling the floor is an automatic thing for me. Hey, boss, come on over and take care of this because I'm not a bad guy, you know.
Yeah, and the best rooms that do that tracking also do break that tracking down based off – was this a dealer error, or this is just a non-dealer error player call?
Yeah.
And goes into their logs that way. So, you know, if they're working in a respectable room, that they should never fear that for that reason. So, and if they're not working in a respectable room, then quite honestly, they need to get a job in one that is.
Yep,
so,
that's right.
You know, easy solutions all around here.
Absolutely. Hey, we got a brand new O'Malley's move. Here we go.
This week's episode is dedicated to Tawny Baird. Tawny, may you rest in peace, and may justice be served. Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I am Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are still at that rare 1-2 PLO8 game. We've had a good run of cards and have been playing fairly well. We've doubled our stack and currently sit with 400. Under the gun limps, plus one folds, MP folds, MP1 calls, and we look down at the ace of spades, jack of spades, four of hearts, four of diamonds, and the hijack. We've got potential both ways in this one, but it isn't super strong, so we limp as well. Maybe a raise was in order? The button limps, small blind completes, big blind checks, and we're going to a flop with $12 and six players seeing it. These guys love to see flops. It comes down the jack of hearts, eight of spades, five of spades. It's checked around to us, and we decide to make a bet. We've got top pair with the nut flush draw, so we're going to bet on the come. But we want to discourage any weak low draws out of this hand. We make a pot-sized bet. Everyone folds except for the big blind, who started this hand with around 250. He seems like a fairly solid player with two leaks. He plays too many hands and can't let go of draws, even if they're not to the nuts. With $36 in the pot, the turn is the ace of hearts. This seems to be a pretty good card for us. We've now made top two and still have the nut flush draw for backup, but it does complete the low. And since our player came out of the big blind, he could really have anything. This is exactly what's going through our mind when he makes a $20 bet. So we've got a decent made hand and a lot of potential to improve. We could even make a weak low. What's the play?
It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is J Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. Check out Jay Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. And this comes from a first-time writer, BJ from Santa Barbara. I always used to think that Santa Barbara was where the Three's Company was, but I think it was Santa Monica.
That's Santa Monica, buddy.
There's too many Santas out there. Yeah. Not enough elves. But anyhow, nice area of the country. So he said he was in, over the summer, he was in Vegas playing a $100 buy-in, no-limit tournament at one of the Las Vegas casinos. There's 63 people in the tournament, and he eventually finished seventh, so it worked out pretty well in the end. I'm guessing that's like right after the bubble, right?
Yeah, I'm hoping he at least gets the bubble money.
Otherwise, I don't know really how he justifies that being working out. But he said he had a couple hands that he agonized over, and I sent them both to us. So I picked what I thought was the best of the two hands, and we'll find out how well he played it, right?
All right.
All right, he's nine-handed, and it's nine-handed at the table. He has 6,000 chips. Blinds are 25 and 50, so probably the first or second level, right? Let's see. He limps in with seat four with pocket fives, five of hearts and five of clubs, and three of callers. So I guess we'll start the analysis on the flop here. Three callers, so four of us go to the flop, which is five of spades, four of spades, nine of diamonds, and the big blind opens for 400.
I like a raise here. This is a very coordinated board, and, you know, especially with limpers, the only thing you're possibly afraid of other than just draws getting there is pocket nines, and I don't know if pocket nines would limp. They might limp. I'm starting to sound like Barack Obama here. I think that a raise is called for here. I don't mind a raise to say... What'd you say it was 400 he opened for?
Opened for 400.
Yeah, I mean, the standard's
which is a pretty large overbet, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
four
really.
Of us,
200 in the pot.
200 in the pot, yeah.
I don't know if I would make it the standard three times just because, like you said, it's already a big bet. I might make it 1,000 because I don't mind this. This guy who bet out probably is trying to protect two or see where everybody is. I don't think that he's got us beat. So I think if I made it like 1,000, maybe a 2.5 or something, that might be, you know, because that's a really big bet. I mean, that's 1/6 your stack.
Sure.
Everybody else, I mean, to them, it's probably 1/6 their stack or even more. You know, you really got to hit this pretty hard to stick around for a 1,000-unit bet. So I think 1,000 is probably enough to do what we want here.
Yeah, a couple things. It's funny that you mentioned bet out to see where they are, because that was the mantra for Brian Devonshire of this cruise. He's like, don't ever bet out to see where you are. That's the worst reason to bet in poker ever, which I love. A couple of other things I think are going on here. One, the 400 is an outrageous bet to begin with, right?
We were talking
about that. But what I kind of see in these $100 or less buy-in tournaments are people don't have a healthy respect for proper betting anyhow, right? So if everybody else is sitting around, I'm assuming it's pretty early here, so everybody else is sitting around about 6,000 in chips, 400 doesn't seem outlandish to them, even though it's incredibly outlandish, right?
Yeah.
So I guess my fear is now if we... So normally, I guess I would say I would just call here because the bet's already outlandish, and who else is going to call 400 here to chase their flush draw? This guy's already took care of that for us, so do we want to commit more chips on a board like this? So half of me is tempted just to call the 400, but the other half of me knows, again, that people don't have a healthy respect for chips here, and if we don't raise here, it's quite possible there could be four of us going to the turn with 400 each in here and a very scary flop that a lot of things could go bad for us, right?
Yeah, well, let's look at it another way, too. Let's say that the two people behind us left to act are a mix of what you said, where one would be afraid to make that first call for 400 to win, what, 1,000 to make their flush draw. But the other one isn't. The other one has a disregard for chips, and that's the guy who calls first. So now you've got 400, 400, 400, 200. So you've got 1,400 in there. Now all you got to do is call 400 to win 1,400 to hit your flush draw if you're that second person who might have folded if he was the first person to act. So now you're thinking, well, you're going to start this sort of domino effect that if you only call for 400, you might get that fourth player to call when he normally wouldn't have called had you made it 1,200 or 1,000. So I do think a re-raise is called for here, or a raise. Because I feel like you said, if there's somebody who has a disregard for chips and you just call, you're going to get another caller who's got some random draw. And you'd like to be heads up with somebody who chooses to bet 400 out here, because you're going to get all that chips, those chips anyway, I think. So to me, I think a raise is called for because it's multi behind you. It'd be one thing if you were heads up with them and it was just a bet and you wanted to call and keep it, you know, outlandish or whatever. But when you have two people behind you, it's a good chance that one of those guys will call that bet because of what you said about them not having any respect for chips. And then if it's the first guy who does that, now the second guy who does have respect is getting good odds to call and hit his crappy draw or whatever. So I'm going to bet 1,000 here.
Yeah, I think I'm fine with 1,000. I also think a min raise is perfectly fine here because the first bet was outrageous. So
yeah, 800.
I mean, 800 now. So, I mean, if somebody's going to put, you know, less, it's more than 10%, 15%, 20% of their chip stack in here on this draw, that's fine. You know, and if that flush or straight gets there and I feel out of heat, then I've saved 200 or 400 based off of what other people might raise there. 800, I think, is perfectly fine at this point.
Yeah.
I'm not going to complain about 1,000. All right, well, our hero goes the full 1,200, okay. But everybody else folds. And he says there's already a nice pot. He says with two diamonds out there, but I think it means spades. Two spades out there. I want to take it down right now, but obviously it's not hand of the week. It would be hand of the week. Gentleman calls. So he doesn't get raised, but he's called. And their heads up going the turn, which is the queen of diamonds. So our flop now is five of spades, four of spades, nine of diamonds, queen of diamonds. So two flush draws out there now.
Okay.
And the big blind checks to us.
All right, so we made it 12, so that means he calls, so that's 24 plus the original, what was in there, 200 or so, right?
Right.
Four-handed, yep. So. All right, so I'd probably bet 1,600 here, I guess.
Yeah, I actually like checking here, to be honest.
Really?
This board is very dangerous, I know. You never like to give a free card. With all this stuff going on, not so much worried about the diamonds now based on him betting out on the flop. So I really kind of discount the diamond as being dangerous at this point. But I think what's happening here is there's so much chip inflation going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're at 25.50, so it's early in the tournament. We obviously got a solid hand here. We got third set here. And I just don't want to bloat the pot here. I want to exercise some pot control. And so I guess the other thing, too, is if I bet here, what happens if he raises? What do we do at that point? Do we feel confident enough that our third set is good and that we're willing to shove and get all of our chips in at the 25-50 level without the nuts?
Yes.
Maybe not.
Yes.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, then yeah, absolutely. I'm not so sure I would be. So if I check behind here, you know, and he decides to bet out on the... A couple things could happen there. On the river, he could bluff at me, because he thinks that I'm scared now, I made this call, now whatever. And that would be great if I called and won. But whatever, or if he hits his flush card, if that's what we think he's on here, he's going to bet a little less, right, probably a value bet. So it's going to be probably about what we would bet right here, right? And so we're not losing any more money because we bet here and he calls and then he hits his flush, then we have to either decide to fold or call even more chips off, right? So I think at this point I'm quite happy just exercising some pot control, and you know, the board gets scary, that's fine, because I don't really think this guy is going to bet more than what a legitimate bet for us would be here on the river.
Arg. I don't know if I could agree with any of that. Arg.
Excellent. That's what makes the show interesting.
Well, I mean, here's the deal. All right, so let me guess. You made it 800 when you re-raise this guy to get the other people out. Is that the only reason you re-raised? To get the other people out?
I think I had the best hand, too.
So what makes you think you have the best hand now?
I'm not saying I don't.
Well, why aren't you betting with the best hand now and protecting against a very dangerous board already?
Okay, all right. Well, I don't know if it's protection if he's going to call me.
Well, if you want to at least make him pay the most amount for his mistake, then.
Very true. Very true.
You're giving him a free shot to do it, and you're willing to pay for it after he hits it.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Are we even assuming... I mean, I guess this is kind of counter to what I'm talking about as well, too, but do we believe he's on a flush draw here?
I don't know.
Twice the pot on the flop?
I don't know for sure if he is or if he isn't. He could be bluffing. But
right, so I mean, I guess at that point, it doesn't seem reasonable to me that this guy's on any kind of draw. So I guess the argument then is, if he's not on draw, then our hand isn't really vulnerable, right? Unless we're already behind. If he has the nines, or let's say he had aces or kings, which we have beat, or if he has queens, now he has his beat, right?
Right.
And who knows what the river is going to be. It could be another set. So I guess you'd go both ways on that. I mean, either we have the best hand now, we might as well get value out of it. If he raises, like you say, we don't care. We feel like we have the best hand, we're going to get it all in. Or if there's some doubt in our mind, and again, it's early in the tournament, this gives us some more options. And we still might be able to win a huge pot off this, depending on what happens.
Yeah, I can't. I just have to bet this turn. I mean, even if, first of all, this guy bet out, then he called us. He bet 400, and he's not on a draw. Then we're ahead, and why aren't we getting more money out of him? And if he's willing to call that 800 without a draw, that means he has a hand that he's willing to go with. So if he has a hand, why am I not betting to get some more money out of him? So if he doesn't have a draw, then I would want to milk this guy for some money. If he does have a draw, I want to get him out. Either way, I want to bet here. There's no reason not to bolt the pot if I have... Pot's already big, but if I have the best hand, I'm going to bolt the pot. I don't care.
I mean, reasonably looking at this hand, I mean, he's not going to overbet the pot on a flop with his pocket nine. So you're probably right. We do have the, unless he has pocket queens. That's the only thing really I'm scared about at this point. Which would probably make sense with that kind of bet. It's still a weird bet. But so, yeah, you're probably right. We have the best hand here. And so, all right, you talk me into it.
All right, yes, I love that. That's not very often I can talk you into stuff. So you're always talking me into shit. So I'm glad I talked you into it.
All right, well, our hero decides to bet 1,500. And he's immediately re-raised to 3,000.
Oh, yeah. We're getting it in. I mean, really, there's no way this guy has a set of... The only thing he has is a set of nines. He can't have a set of queens. There's no way he's limping with a set of queens preflop. So...
I don't know about that.
Oh, come on.
I don't think the pocket nines make sense with that overbet on the flop. I mean, I guess it could. I guess he's really scared about the flush and wants the Bishuri. Possible, I guess, but... Those are the only two hands that have his beat right now, right?
And yeah.
I really think the flush draws are meaningless. Straight draws as well, too.
Yeah, I'm getting it in there. I'm really sorry, but if you don't agree with me, I'm sorry. But there is no way I'm letting a set of fives go with a 5-4-9 queen board and no race preflop. I mean, I just can't see maybe 9-9 limps because he limped ahead of us. But really, if you're ahead of us with 9-9, you're probably raising. I don't see people entering a pot with 9-9. Especially with other limpers, because you're going to have to raise 20 cards, or you have to hit a set. You have to set mine with nines when it's a valuable hand. So if it's queen-queen, there's just no way somebody's limping with queen-queen. There's just no way, because if you're up front, you're gonna raise, and if you're later, you're going to get those guys out. You're not going to continue to limp with queen-queen.
See, but you're playing rational poker, though. Yeah, this is a $100 tournament.
Well, I got to do that.
I can't tell you how many times I'm in a tournament, and I see somebody limp with aces, kings, or queens, and then they get it all in the flop because they think they're being clever, and they're being clever walking all the way to the parking lot.
I can't put somebody on 9-9.
So I'm not dismissing queen-queen here at all. I think it's a very reasonable holding, even though...
Wait, you just said I'm playing rational poker, but now the queen-queen's reasonable. It can't be reasonable. It's irreasonable.
It's reasonable because your opponents are irrational. You're rational. So you got to consider that.
All right, so it's reasonable for us to think that because they're unreasonable.
There you go.
All right.
That sounds wonderful.
Okay, I'm not going with that. I'm going with shoving.
I'm not saying that's a reason to be scared of it, but I'm not gonna bet the house on the fact that we're not up against a set of queens right now.
I got you. So he made it $3,000. Yeah, I'm all in.
All right. Here it says, I know I can't just call. It's most likely going to be for my whole stack on the river anyway. It's push or fold, and it's tough to fold here, I think.
Yeah.
It's like, but what an agonizing fold that would be, absolutely. He says that by this time I've got at least a decent read on this guy. He is an aggressive sort of loose player, young college guy, in Vegas for fun. Already blew $15,000 down in the World Series of Poker the previous day. So he's quite capable of raising me big with a lot of different hands that could have caught part of the flop, and most likely he has at least a draw or two. First of all, can you talk about how horrible your trip to Vegas is if you blew $15,000 in the World Series the next day and now you're in a $100 tournament?
Yeah, I mean, really? And why are you paying $15,000 to enter a $10,000 event?
Yeah, maybe there's a broker fee there, man. We didn't get involved in this business.
So oh, man, we're in the wrong business.
Maybe you did $5,000 worth of satellites.
Yeah, that could be it, too. And now he's entering a $100 tournament. So if this guy's played $15,000 World Series event, if I had known that information up front, I would have said, well, I don't think this guy's playing irrationally now.
That's probably true.
He's probably a decent player. Although he could be irrational because he's so depressed.
Yeah, because he's playing well below his, technically, I guess what would be his means, right?
Yeah, he's on tilt.
If you and I enter a $1 tournament, you know, we're not going to be playing the same way as if we played a $1,000 tournament, right?
Right. Yeah, he could be on tilt, so... but I'm still sticking with my guns. I don't think he has 9-9 or queen-queen. I just don't.
I wake up with my head sewn to the carpet, and I'd be less surprised than if he had a draw here. I don't think there's no possible he has a draw here.
I mean, he could have an ace-9 of spades, right? Because that's a limping hand, top pair, top kicker, and then nice up nut flush draw, and he's saying, hey.
That could make sense with the overbet, yeah.
Yeah. He could do all kinds of stuff to get you to think differently, because it would be brilliant if he has ace-9 of spades and you're second-guessing or folding a good hand here. So that's the only hand I can think of, though, really, that would warrant this and still be around it, making it $3,000 and not to be queen-queen 9-9. Right, exactly.
I can see 5-4 playing this way, or 9-5 or 9-4. Those are all hands possible as well.
Yeah, 5-4 he could have limped with. So, yeah, that's something, too, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and he's a big blind, so he didn't even have to limp.
Yeah, you know, there you go.
Right? Yep. Right, so he could have really any two cards, right? But I really don't believe the draw the way he played it. But we'll see.
Okay.
Mario says, I'm looking at a double flush draw. My thinking is that his betting would have been reasonable for two big diamonds or even two big spades. Possible trip nines, unlikely, but definitely a reasonable hand for him to have. He could have a zillion hands that could draw out of me on the river. Ace, king, ace, queen, ace, jack. Neither diamonds or spades. He could also have ace, ace, king, king, queen, queen, jack, jack, and trip me out on the river. None of those is likely, but the sheer number of ways to lose on this one makes me nervous. So... He's scaring himself, I think, a little bit, right?
Whoa. I gotta take a step back here. All of those hands, those hands are all raising hands, especially if you're in the big blind. You're going to be out of position the rest of the hand. I don't care if you're playing irrationally or not. Nobody looks down at ace-ace in the big blind with limpers ahead of them and just says, eh, wrap the table.
I would say no one.
But. Okay, but come on. Especially this guy is playing the World Series the day before for 15 grand. I mean, come on. You got to have some reasonable expectation. If you're playing with everyone who's irrational for the rest of your life, you can never do a range of hands, and you might as well just play ABC poker and just look at your own cards and never think about anything. I mean, you have to give some credence to the guy who knows how to play poker. You know, I mean, I just can't imagine ace, ace, king, king, queen, queen, jack, jack being in this hand in the big blind with four limpers. I just can't. You have to, and so you're scaring yourself for no reason, and you can't play a poker hand by saying, if he draws out, I can't be afraid of multiple draws by the river. You're ahead. You're winning. You've got a set. And also, cards that hit his hand could also give you a boat or quads. I mean, I just don't know. I just can't possibly see all of those scenarios being possible hands that you have to be afraid of. I mean, you could do that with every single hand of your entire life then and say, I'm afraid of all of these things.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, there's always going to be more hands that beat you than...
Right. Unless you have the mortal nuts, there's no way that you are ever going to be able to play a hand to the river ever again then, if you feel that way. You have a set of fives, and you play this hand back in your mind. Nothing makes sense that's beating you right now. And if something could beat you on the river, well, something could not beat you on the river, too. So there you go, 50-50. You know what I mean? You can't feel that way. You have to think about what makes sense. And none of those hands make sense. I mean, they just don't. Except for maybe two spades. But again, if they're that high, he would have raised preflop anyway. So something like ace, nine of spades, maybe. But still, you can't lose except for to a flush. And it's not there yet. Get your money in. That's what I would say.
Wow. Calm down, buddy.
I'm so excitable. It's Halloween.
No, I absolutely agree with you on most of that. So I'm certainly not folding this. And unfortunately, that's what our hero did.
Oh, he folded.
He decided there are too many ways to lose. He says, I rarely ever reveal my hands, but after my opponent mucked ace four of clubs face up, I did, and several of us discussed it at length. So, totally got...
Ace four? So he had a pair of fours?
Yeah.
All right, wait a minute. So even if we called the 3,000, all right, and we had put, what, 1,200, and so that's 42. So we still have, like, 1,800 with blinds at 2,550.
Right, yep.
We still had enough to see the river and not make this a mistake. And the river could have given you a boat. The river could have not gotten any of those draws there. Oh, I just can't fold there. And I mean, I'm not saying I would have called, but if I would rather call and have 1,800 to see the river with and maybe get away from it if it's really a scary card. But, oh, I couldn't fold there. Oh, man. Sorry,
yeah,
man.
I think he's going to want this one back, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, obviously, after he saw what he had. But I think you make the other good point, too, and this is what I talk about a lot, too. I mean, 2550, you're right. Even if you make that call and you got the 1,800 left and you decide to fold on the river, which would probably be just as bad as folding here. But even if you did that, at that point, you've got so many chips left.
Almost like 40. So it's like 38 big blinds or something.
I mean, the only reason that it's not exciting at that point is, as I was talking about, the chip inflation at that point. If people are going to keep firing $400 flop bets and $200 pots, yeah, then the 1,800 shrivels up a little bit more. But rationally thinking, that is a ton of play left for you. And I know you're looking around at everybody else, and everybody else has 6,000, you have 1,800, but that really doesn't matter at that point.
Right.
You know? And certainly doesn't matter to the point where you're going to fold a super strong hand like you have here. Because you're scared.
Yeah, that's too bad. It's too bad. I mean, and then you lost to a pair of fours. So this guy was pretty much just on tilt and a maniac.
So the rest of this is a little bit interesting, I think. He says, obviously I had him beat, but my argument was the myriad ways I could have lost. And a point in the tournament where I've got lots of chips. It's not like I'm going to get blinded out. And he said, I was crazy to fold. My friend I respect said likewise, but look at what you raised me with to 3,000. I read on the guide was very accurate. He acted with even less than I figured on. So what do you think? Mubs, which I like. It took me a while to figure that out, but monster under the bed syndrome. Actually never heard that before. Am I guilty? Yeah, absolutely you're guilty. But it's funny because we were just talking about the fact that 1,800 chips is a lot, 2550, right?
Yeah.
And he kind of used that argument, but to his detriment, right? He was thinking, hey, if I fold now, I've got 4,000 or whatever he has left. Yeah, 2550. And generally, I don't have that problem. It's early in the tournament. You know, don't make crazy calls early in the tournament. There's no reason to. But this is not a crazy one. I mean, we had a set here. And the more we talked about it, and obviously in the heat of the moment, maybe it would have been more difficult. Because obviously I was probably on the wrong side of it for a while until you slapped me upside the head. but this is kind of what you're looking for early on, right?
I think so.
This kind of situation, and if you got it all in, obviously this guy isn't going to call. I think if you shove there, he's going to fold. But even if he folds there, at that point you picked up 3,000 from him, or more than that, right? Plus with the blinds, and now you've got 10,000 or something with 2550. Now you're in a commanding spot very early in the tournament, and you could be even pickier going forward if you want to.
Absolutely. He'll have over 10,000 chips, and if the guy folded after you shoved, and if he called, then you know you're going to have it because he only had a pair of fours. So right. I think that was, you know, that was costly, but I think he'll learn from it. You know, I mean, there's a fine line between, you know, monsters under the bed and quality, you know, range finding of hands here. You just got to go back over what he said earlier about some of the hands that he put up. Plus, he was using both flush draws against him. You can't. It's not like there was two possible flush draws and we were playing Omaha. I mean, you can either have one or the other flush draw. So you can't use both of those flush draws as reasons to fold too. It's one or the other. You know, so it's really only one flush draw that's out there because only one player against you. It's not like you're up against two players. So you just got to really think about the possibilities and the story that was being told. The only hand, like you said, makes sense is maybe a baby two pair that he's overbetting to get you out of the pot after the flop. And he's calling because he loves his two pair and doesn't really believe you or something. But other than that, you know, there's no hand that beats you except for 9-9 and queen. And those hands make zero sense at that point in the hand. So I just think, you know, check raise you with 9-9, I don't think so. I think, or queen especially, I think that just playing the hand over in your head. Take your time at the table, think about it, and you'll make better decisions.
Yeah, and out of respect, just to mention to BJ, because the hand before was the same tournament, and we won't get into much of it, but it kind of, I think, influenced his action here. He had 8,000 to start with, and had king preflop, and was facing two all-ins and decided to fold. Which I think was the right move. One of the opponents turned over ace-ace. The other one, ace-queen. Of course, the flop had a king, so he would have tripled up had he made the call. But I think it was a good laydown. So I think he was a little shell-shocked
over
that. And that influenced him here, which is not an appropriate reason for this. It's just an acknowledgement of where your mindset is.
Yeah, that's too bad. All right, but you made on the show a hand of the week, so that's got to be something. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.